I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Pennsylvania has been called a battleground state this year, although the latest polls show that Hillary Clinton has a sizable lead over Donald Trump. Last Friday, Donald Trump raised the possibility of voter fraud in the Commonwealth at a rally in Altoona.
Is everybody here voting? If you do that, we're not going to lose. The only way we can lose, in my opinion, I really mean this, Pennsylvania, is if cheating goes on. I really believe it. Because I looked at Erie, and it was the same thing as this. And I've been all over the state, and I know the state well. But let me just tell you, I looked all over Pennsylvania, and I'm studying it. And we have some great people here, some great leaders here of the Republican Party. And they're very concerned about that. And that's the way we can lose the state. And we have to call up law enforcement, and we have to have the sheriffs and the police chiefs and everybody watching. Because if we get cheated out of this election, if we get cheated out of a win in Pennsylvania, which is such a vital state, especially when I know what's happening here, folks, I know she can't beat what's happening here. The only way they can beat it, in my opinion, and I mean this 100%, if in certain sections of the state, they cheat. Okay?
A few years ago, a judge ruled against Pennsylvania's voter ID law, calling it invalid and unconstitutional. The ACLU had filed a lawsuit against the law, and when it came to presenting the evidence of in-person voter fraud, the government came up empty-handed. But the charges of voter fraud have not gone away. We asked Jennifer Clark to join us. She is the executive director of the Public Interest Law Center here in Philadelphia, one of the lawyers part of this ACLU lawsuit. And Jennifer Clark, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be back, Marty, but I'm sorry we're still talking about the same old thing.
Absolutely. We could pull out an old interview with you and probably play it right back. Is there cheating in Pennsylvania?
No, Marty, there's not cheating. There has still been no evidence of in-person voter fraud. Over and over again, people make these allegations, but we really have that in our rearview mirror now. It's really been demonstrated that this is not a fraud that people do. It doesn't make sense. It's hard to do.
Well, let me ask you, why is it hard to do and why doesn't it make sense? I mean, if someone were to do this, how would they do it and how might they be punished?
Well, here's why it's hard. So this is a crime. What you'd have to do is I would go into a polling place and say I'm Joe Smith. And I'm going into a polling place where I have to know that Joe Smith is registered there. Other people may know Joe Smith. Joe Smith may have already voted. I am committing a crime by doing this, so I'm committing a crime in front of people. Or Joe Smith may not have voted, but then he comes and votes. So I have committed a crime in front of a lot of people. Now, what am I doing this for? I'm going to add one vote. So it really doesn't make sense. I'm subjecting myself to going to jail. And why would I do that?
Let me quote U.S. Representative Bill Schuster. He also spoke at this Altoona rally. He said, "The people in western and central Pennsylvania have to overcome what goes on down in Philadelphia, the cheating, what they do. We've got to make sure we're doing the job here in central Pennsylvania." So why? I mean, a judge ruled on this. The state did not present any evidence of in-person voter fraud, and yet this continues.
Right.
Why?
Well, I think that people want to talk about cheating. They want to talk about fraud, but there isn't evidence. That's the problem that Donald Trump has. That's the problem Bill Schuster has. There isn't evidence.
When we hear about voter ID, and I remember doing so many shows about this when it was the law here in Pennsylvania, and a number of people saying, you know, why is this a burden? Why is it a burden for someone to have a driver's license or some form of official government ID? You were part of this lawsuit that pushed back on that. Why is that a burden?
Well, a lot of people want to have ID, but they have a hard time getting it. Because in order to get an ID, you had to have a birth certificate. You had to have other kinds of ID that people also didn't have. So what we were able to do over the course of a 3-week trial was to show that there are lots of people who would like to have an ID, but they just can't get all the documents that you need in order to get an ID. And they had to go to a PennDOT facility. There were only 59 in the – there weren't that many. There were counties that didn't have any at all.
Who was burdened? I mean, when you look at this law, who bore the burden of a voter ID?
Right. So when we looked at the – who didn't have one, and there were the count ranged 500,000 to 700,000. They were low-income people because they were people who didn't have driver's licenses. They were older people. They were younger people. And our data was that it was there was a disproportionate number of Latino people.
So an interesting – and when you look at that group, and not to get partisan here, but certainly when there's talk about voter suppression or voter cheating in Philadelphia, one often thinks of race because of the makeup of the city. How do we factor that in?
Well, we certainly hear Donald Trump's call to go to see those people. We understand that he's talking about – African-American voters in Philadelphia. It's clearly a racially motivated, racially based call. There's no place for that in American politics.
Does this hurt our democracy when a candidate talks that way?
Yeah, it does. In particular, there's no place for voter intimidation. What we're seeing, what we hear in Mr. Trump calling for sheriffs to come to Philadelphia, that sounds like voter intimidation, and there's no place for that in American democracy.
But if a sheriff that's a law enforcement person, why would that be considered voter intimidation?
We have a system of election protection in Pennsylvania. So to have outsiders coming in, law enforcement people, again, it's code. It's something that sounds like we're going to have people come and intimidate our African-American voters.
This is more anecdotal, and certainly people have called in, and I've heard this when we've done programs about elections, which is sometimes it feels like there are sort of shady-looking people standing on the sidewalk, or you have to walk by some people that make someone might feel uncomfortable. Is that a form of voter intimidation? Is there a way to monitor that?
Well, there is a way. And one of the great things about Pennsylvania is that we have a lot of existing structures to help prevent voter intimidation. So we have election protection, which has been around for a long time. It's run by the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. Those are trained, nonpartisan election observers. We have laws that say that you have to stand a certain distance away from the polling place. So we do have a concern about voter intimidation. If people are standing around who aren't known, who are in a group, so we have to be careful about that.
There was the charge about the new Black Panther Party, that there were two members of the party. This goes back a couple of years, that may or may not have intimidated some people at a polling place. And I've looked at this from multiple sides, and it's hard to know exactly what went on there. But that is used as an example of some kind of voter intimidation.
Right. So I think that what you're saying is correct. No one actually knows what happened there. But what we do draw from that is that there is no place for voter intimidation on either side. It's a nonpartisan demand. We can't have that in our election system.
Let me read a couple of comments. A tweet from Glenn says he won't carry Philadelphia or Pittsburgh, a given, and the race will be tight. A comment from Robert: it's just not interesting to have all this critical focus on Trump and virtually none on Clinton. And I would say earlier this week we talked about the Clinton Foundation, so we're trying to cover both sides. An email from Paul, he says, yes, there's cheating by gerrymandering, and that's something I'm going to be talking with our other two guests about. But do you see the potential for or cheating or perhaps even voter suppression the way we gerrymander districts?
So gerrymandering is a very different problem, and it's a problem that comes up every 10 years when we redistrict. Yes, there is a big problem. We all know that there were more Democratic voters who voted, but they sent fewer Republicans to Congress. So it's a problem, but it's a different problem than what happens on Election Day. It's a problem that we have we have to figure out before the next time that we do our redistricting.
Well, and even putting all this together, as we've done so many shows about voting in this country, there is this feeling, and I've sometimes felt it myself, you go in and you vote and you wonder, I wonder if that registered. I mean, it does sometimes feel like an act of faith. Right. You have to believe that the people running that polling district or the people overseeing all that, that everything is in place.
You know, that's actually the magic of it, but it's also what we should be focusing on. The magic of it is that in churches and in libraries and in schools and in apartment buildings and garages all over this city and all over this country, people are voting and really volunteers are running the polling place. So that's the magic of it. But what we should be focusing on is improving those administrative systems, because all of the, quote, fraud that people talk about are usually mistakes. Occasionally, the poll workers do commit fraud and they get caught, and that's why we know it. But really, we should be focusing on making it easier for people to vote, to update our election system so that it's easier and we tighten up on the administration.
How would we do that? How would we make voting easier?
So we are fortunate right now that we have a state administration that's really focused on that. So already we have online voter registration. 100,000 people have used that. So that's great, because those people have either are new registrants or they've used it to change their addresses. We are only one of 9 states that doesn't have early voting and doesn't have no-fault absentee balloting. So we are behind the curve on that. So really, when we're thinking about what we should be doing and what we should be worrying about and what we should be talking about, it's really those kinds of things. Let's make it easier for people to vote. Let's make it more convenient. You know, actually, Pennsylvanians are very proud of our election system. You know, I think that people may be offended by an attack on our system. Our data shows that people are proud of it. But the thing that people actually worry about is the low rate of turnout. And what people want to do and what people would like to change is the fact that it's difficult, or they'd like to improve the access to the ballot.
And we're almost out of time here, but the idea of cheating, do you think that depresses turnout if there's this someone is making that charge?
I think it could, and that's why really we would like to change the conversation from cheating, which is just not founded. It's just not founded, to we're proud of this system. It's a good system, and the people who really care about the ballot are working to make it better. There's a group called Keystone Votes, which is working on that.
Jennifer Clark, thank you for stopping by, coming in our studios and talking about Pennsylvania and voting. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And she's the executive director of the Public Interest Law Center. I just see the news. Paul Manafort has just resigned as Trump's campaign chairman. Just a piece of news. We will talk more about voting after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe. Just a recap here. Donald Trump told his supporters at a rally in Altoona last week that if he loses Pennsylvania to Hillary Clinton in November, it will be because of cheating. He made a veiled reference to Philadelphia. He also called for more poll watchers. Not the first time someone has charged voter fraud in the Commonwealth, although there is almost no evidence of that. And Jennifer Clark from the Public Interest Law Center was just talking about voter laws and rights in Pennsylvania. Well, we want to talk about this debate over voter fraud across the country and ways to increase voter participation. And we asked Edward Foley to join us. He's a professor at the Moritz College of Law at The Ohio State University. And he wrote a book called Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. And Ned Foley, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Do we have him? We will get him up. And we also hopefully have Richard Pildes, and he's the Sudler Family Professor of Constitutional Law at NYU School of Law. And Richard Pildes joining us by Skype. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
I think I'm actually here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, and I'm very glad to have you with us. And hopefully we will track down Ned Foley and get him in on the conversation. Okay.
Marty, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Okay, we're all set and good to go. Let me put this first to you, Edward Foley, and I'd like to get you, Richard Pildes, to get in on this conversation. And we were just talking about the fact that Donald Trump basically said that if he loses in Pennsylvania, it would be because of cheating. And I wonder, Edward Foley, your response to a charge like that.
Well, I think that charge is way overstated and not very responsible. There's no reason to think going into the election that the result will be because of fraud or cheating or malfeasance. So I guess I reject that statement and that characterization. What I do think is important to add to the conversation, though, is that transparency is one of the most important values in a democracy, and we think that observation of the electoral process is a good thing in order to avoid anything going wrong. We want countries overseas that call themselves democracies to have election observation. We send observers to countries like Afghanistan and so forth when they run elections, and we should have a transparent system as well. So I hope that value doesn't get lost in the debate.
Oh, me neither, and I will pick up on that. Let me give you, Richard Pildes, a chance to weigh in on this as well. And I was just talking with Jennifer Clark about this sort of whole history of challenges of in-person voter fraud in Pennsylvania. The state, when this was in court, was unable to come up with any evidence of in-person voter fraud, and yet this continues. Why? Why does this endure?
Well, I think that you know, there's a perception among some people that that this is a problem. There's a belief that it's very difficult to actually ferret it out if it is going on. The evidence in American election history, at least over recent decades, is that where we may have a problem with ballot fraud is in the absentee ballot context, not in the context of in-person voting. And it's logical to think that there would be more of a problem with absentee ballots because, of course, those ballots can be marked in front of somebody who can observe how you vote. And that's where the real concern has been in terms of actual practice. We had an election in Miami that was thrown out for absentee ballot fraud. But in terms of actual in-person voting fraud, it's very difficult to find any meaningful evidence, even in elections that have been very intensely scrutinized, for example, during recount processes, of any significant level of in-person voter fraud. And frankly, I think it's playing with fire to raise these kinds of allegations in advance of the election. It's an extremely explosive and dangerous kind of rhetoric to throw around. And it's very, very disappointing to hear at this stage in the American democratic process.
Dangerous because what? It creates some kind of voter suppression, or whoever wins becomes is seen as somehow illegitimate?
Yeah, the concern is that, you know, one of the great features of a long-running stable democracy like that in the United States is that losers accept the results of elections. They know there's a chance to fight another day. We have all of these practices, these norms, these cultural understandings that actually are a tremendous achievement that as we look at other countries around the world trying to build democracies, you know, we realize even more how rare and fragile these achievements are. And one of these achievements is that we accept the results of elections as long as they're run in a valid, fair, transparent process. And there's just no reason to believe that the kind of allegations that are being thrown around right now about Pennsylvania have any basis in fact.
Let me go back to you, Ned Foley, and just one more thing. And this is a some research that's been cited by a lot of people. A law professor looked at cases all over the country, I think counted something like a billion votes cast and found 31 instances of proven cases of voter fraud. And it seems, I mean, if that doesn't put this to rest, I don't know what would. But nonetheless, we've got Donald Trump raising this specter.
No, I mean, that's correct. That I know the study that you're referring to, and I want to echo what Rick just said. You know, I think that part of the reason why allegations get thrown around is because we have a competitive political process. I do think the rhetoric that we're seeing now is way over the top and disconcerting for the reasons that Rick said. You know, one of the things I sometimes tell my students is, you know, there is this old cliche, where there's smoke, there's fire. Well, that isn't always true in the electoral system. Sometimes candidates and parties want to sort of throw smoke on the situation, particularly around Election Day, just in the hopes that they might uncover something to dispute or fight about. And as our system is getting more and more polarized, we're getting more and more of these sorts of allegations. The danger, as Rick said, is that the public will start to lose confidence in the process if there's too many irresponsible allegations thrown around. But it also is important to pick up on the other half of what Rick said. The fact that in-person voter impersonation fraud is minuscule, it's not a problem, doesn't mean that we shouldn't be vigilant with respect to the process as a whole and transparent with the process as a whole. And as he said, absentee ballots is the domain where, if nefarious conduct were to occur, it would be most likely to occur there. And Miami, Florida, was the biggest election in recent years affected by that kind of fraud. There was also in the 1990s, I think, a state Senate race near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. There was unfortunate sort of a systematic effort to try to abuse the absentee voting process. So that does happen from time to time. It's not just Florida. It's not just Pennsylvania, Illinois, other states. So you do want to watch out for that.
Is that more, Rick, likely? Is that more likely in down ballot races?
You mean the problem of actual absentee ballot fraud?
Yes,
sure. Because the smaller the number of votes it takes to win an election, the fewer fraudulent absentee ballots you have to put together to actually tip the outcome. So, you know, if you think about this at the presidential election in Pennsylvania, if you believe the current polls that have Hillary Clinton up by about 9%, that's about 500,000 votes more than Donald Trump would have, you know, based on last presidential election turnout. I mean, that's a massive number of votes. But if you have a local government race where the outcome may turn on 25 votes, something like that, you know, the advantage of organizing a concerted absentee ballot fraud campaign is greater, and it's easier to pull it off. Let me just say one thing to provide some perspective
sure.
on the issue of voter identification in the United States. I mean, in some sense, I think that it might be, you know, in an ideal world, it would be a good thing for the confidence for people in the system if we had, you know, a kind of a photo identification that all eligible voters had easy access to. And in fact, in most democracies around the world, this isn't an issue precisely because they have national identification cards, and that's what they show when they go to vote. We don't have those in the United States. And so the problem here is not the objection isn't to having people show identification to prove who they are. It's that in the U.S., there are significant numbers of people who don't actually have the kinds of photo IDs that are required by some of these laws, even though they're eligible to vote. So if states could roll out systems in which everybody would have easy access to photo IDs who are eligible to vote, then the problem might, you know, disappear over time. But that's why it takes the shape it does in the U.S.
And easy access seems to be the operative word. It certainly was tried here in Pennsylvania, but a judge ruled that it was invalid, unconstitutional, and was a burden to voting because it was difficult for people who didn't have cars, for instance, to try to go drive, you know, 30 or 40 miles to go get their ID.
Correct. And, you know, as states, if they continue to want to pursue these kinds of laws, given these court decisions, they'll have to work harder to make IDs available for people who are actually eligible to vote in, easily accessible ways so that you are providing protection for the integrity of the process at the same time that you're not disenfranchising anybody who is actually, you know, eligible to cast a ballot.
Let me reintroduce the two of you. That's Richard Pildes, Rick Pildes. He is a professor of constitutional law and at NYU School of Law, joining us by Skype. And joining us by phone is Edward Foley, Ned Foley, and he's a professor at the Moritz College of Law at Ohio State University. Wrote a book called Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email. I see a bunch of them, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Ned, let me go back to you, and let's go back to the founders. Did they give us today any kind of guidance about how we can make voting easier and prevent either suppression or intimidation?
In a word, no, or certainly not sufficient. In fact, one of the episodes that I discovered for my book took place in Philadelphia before the Constitution was even written, where they were fighting over the results of an important Pennsylvania election, and they were doing it because of coercion that took place at the polling places. It was in the midst, the Revolutionary War was still going on. It was in 1781, and one side had soldiers that went to the polls to try to stop voters from voting on the other side, and the question was whether to throw out the ballots that were coerced and throw out the election. And the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania at the time split over that, and sort of split philosophically in the ways that we see in a number of disputes. So this issue of fighting over votes has been with us from the founding, and there are sort of structural reasons why, particularly when we have close elections, why they're difficult to handle. And one point that Rick made, I think, is worth echoing. The kinds of issues that I discuss in my book only apply in very close elections, when we say that the margin of litigation is closer than exceeds the margin of victory. Rick was talking about when you have a result of 500,000 votes, you're not going to fight over the outcome. It's right. Just not close enough.
Right. Well, I wonder, too, and let me go back to you, and Rick, and then we'll get some folks to join our conversation. The way we do elections, of course, it's the responsibility of the states and in certain cases, the local districts. Would it make sense, and maybe it's not constitutional, to have a system that is uniform across the country rather than some states where you can vote early, some states where you can't vote early, some states that have hanging chads, some states that don't? Is that part of our problem of voting, is that we've got so many different ways to do it?
I do think that for national elections, and of course the highest office in the land, the presidency, it is really a remarkable feature of the United States that so much of the process is decentralized down to the state level and even, as you say, down to the local level in some cases. You may remember in the Florida 2000 election, the ballots being misprinted in certain counties in Florida. And there's no question that Congress does have the power to set the rules for national elections if it wanted to. I mean, for example, Congress could adopt a uniform nationwide rule on early voting days. But historically in the United States, these issues have been handled at the state and local level. And so you have a tremendous amount of inertia that's sort of locked in that current system. It's just not perceived to be something that Congress deals with, even though it does have the power to do it. My own view is that, yes, we would be better off if we had more uniform rules for national elections instead of such an incredibly decentralized system.
Let me read an email from Barbara. I'll put this to you, Ned. She says the number one way to increase voter participation in Pennsylvania is to open the primaries. We're one of the few states in our nation that holds onto a primary system that is essentially a private race between the two parties rather than an open election participated by all legally registered voters. Where do you come down on that?
Well, I think we could talk about the primary system. Again, different states run primaries in different ways. The parties also have their own choice about whether to make them open primaries or closed primaries. They have First Amendment rights that are relevant in that. Actually, in terms of voter participation, I think Pennsylvania is interesting and as a swing state, an important state that doesn't have early voting the way some other states do. So if I were looking to expand voter participation in Pennsylvania, I might want to put early voting on the list of things to look at as well.
What do you think, Rick, about the idea of letting everyone vote in the primary, assuming they're registered, and party be damned?
Yeah, I'm not so enamored of that suggestion. I mean, this is a long, complicated story, but I think our system works best when we have a sort of a mix of popular participation and a significant role for the party figures throughout the country. That's the way we ran primary elections up until the 1970s for the presidency. So I think there's an important role that party figures do play in helping to select the nominees for their candidates, choosing people who are credible, who they believe will appeal to a general electorate, who they have some experience with in terms of their track record. So I like a system that has retains more of a mix of popular participation and also some role for the party figures.
Ned, how did our founders feel about parties?
They thought that they would get rid of them, and that's part of the problem. They thought they could design a constitution that would keep factions in check, so you would have farmers and bankers and other and merchants never coalescing into the kind of two-party system that we have. And so what they really didn't anticipate was statewide and national elections where you had this competitive two-party system that we currently have. And that's why they didn't give us the institutions that we need, particularly nonpartisan institutions. So we, as Rick sort of pointed out, other countries in the world have nonpartisan election administration agencies because they know they can't trust either political party to run the process. We don't have that in America. For counting ballots, again, other democracies try to put that in the hands of nonpartisan tribunals. We don't tend to do that, and that's because we thought we could avoid the presence of political parties for these sorts of issues.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. I see a lot of people want to join it. And talking with Edward Foley, Ned Foley, he's a professor at the Moritz College of Law at Ohio State University, wrote a book called Ballot Battles. Also with us, Richard Pildes. Rick Pildes, and he's a professor of constitutional law at NYU School of Law. And you can join our conversation. We're talking about how to increase voting and also how to ensure that the voting process is fair and clean and balanced. And that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Let's get Dale from Chester County to join our conversation. And Dale, go ahead. You're on the air.
I know this is probably not as important as other people think, but it's important to me.
Go ahead.
I resent some developer from New York. I was born in Pennsylvania. I've lived in Pennsylvania. I resent being called a crook by this man. I find that offensive. And I'm sure there are a lot of other people that do, too. No, I'm not a crook. None of my friends are crooks. And we don't disobey the law. And I'm amazed. I'm amazed. And I'm with Michael Bloomberg on this when he said he was from New York and he could recognize a con when he sees one.
All right, Dale.
I guess that's not a very important thing to
no,
say.
No, no, no. It's a very important thing.
I'm
sure you're not alone, Dale, and I really appreciate the call to Radio Times. And, I mean, Rick, there are risks then when you accuse an entire state and its people, including Dale, of the potential for cheating.
Well, it is also true that sometimes you mobilize your opponents with your rhetoric in these fights about voting integrity, access to the ballot box, and the like. So it can be a little bit of a two-edged sword for candidates, I guess.
Dale, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let's get John from looks like Downingtown to join our conversation. Yeah, go ahead, John. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Hey, hi. My question was, I thought voter fraud was large numbers of illegal aliens getting registered to vote. I thought that was the concern with voter fraud. Is it possible for that to happen?
Well, and perhaps we should put this to you, Ned, but perhaps we should expand on what we're talking about. How do you define voter fraud?
So I define it as the intentional effort to manipulate the result of the election, you know, through either ballot box stuffing or some other way that the outcome is not the authentic product of what the eligible voters wanted to do. So to me, for there to be fraud, there has to be the intent to manipulate the vote count. Sometimes there are invalid ballots cast without a fraudulent intent. People do make mistakes. Election officials make mistakes, and so do sometimes citizens. And I wouldn't consider that to be fraud at all. Usually, again, it's very low volume, but sometimes it can affect the outcome of an election. There have been races out in California in recent decades with relatively small numbers of non-citizens kind of making it through the system. There was a congressional race from the 1990s, not enough to affect the outcome, but more than a handful, but no evidence of any concerted fraudulent intent, just kind of a misunderstanding. The biggest recent statewide election that was affected by invalid ballots was Washington State's governor's election of 2004, where over 1,000 invalid ballots were cast by former felons who had been disenfranchised. Whether you agree with that policy or disagree with that, the state made it improper for convicted felons to vote, and yet over 1,000 did. Again, it wasn't a concerted conspiracy, but the margin of victory was 127 votes, and there were over 1,000 invalid ballots. So, you know, that, and that's a 21st century election. So, again, that's why you need auditing systems and mechanisms to avoid mistakes as well as fraud.
Rick, let me read an email. With computerized voting machines, isn't hacking into the voting results a more significant risk than voter fraud? Can ballot stuffing really happen?
There is a significant concern about among cybersecurity people about moving towards electronic voting systems, and that's why we have very little of that in the United States. And that's why there is a paper trail for most of the voting systems that we do have. I think that, you know, there are a lot of cybersecurity experts who say that we're not ready yet in terms of security to move to, you know, a fully online kind of voting system. And we basically don't have that in the United States.
I mean, we can bank.
And Marty,
Ned. Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, if I were to worry about one thing about Pennsylvania this year, and I don't want to overstate the risk, but my understanding is that Pennsylvania is a state that, at least for some of its localities, uses electronic voting machines that have no paper record. That's not to say that I think Pennsylvania's machines are going to get hacked this year. If they're not hooked up to the internet, it's unlikely that they could get malware. But the folks who know this in terms of the technology say that you need a paper record that you can audit. And Pennsylvania is not alone. There's a few other states that still have, you know, purely electronic systems. So, you know, that's something that I would recommend that the state of Pennsylvania change in terms of getting to different voting technology.
I mean, Rick, we can bank online. Why can't we vote online?
Yeah, that's a question that comes up very often. And, you know, I'm not a cybersecurity person. But I think that, you know, there is not enough confidence yet, given the stakes in a presidential election, that we have developed systems, especially with this highly decentralized system of elections we have, that can guarantee the kind of security you need for a national election. I mean, we may get there at one point in time, but I don't think there's any expert consensus that the system is safe enough for that yet.
Ned, do you want to add anything to that? Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, just your point about banking. When, you know, when I go to the electronic bank machine, I get a paper receipt of my transaction. Because we have secret ballots, as the consumer, you can't take home a paper record of your own vote. The paper audit system would have to be, you know, with the voting officials themselves. So the analogy to banking, while it sort of makes sense at an intuitive level, it's not a perfect analogy in terms of the electoral process.
Let me read a couple of more comments. One from Randy. I find it amusing that you don't need ID to vote, but you need it to get on a plane or buy a six-pack. A tweet from Tabitha. Why can't all primaries be on the same day like the general election? Also, I feel strongly that it is a countrywide problem. There's no paper trail in Delaware County. Just picking up on some of the comments we have here. Let me just flip our conversation if I could. And Rick, I'll start with you. So what can we do to increase voter participation? And I'm thinking about the kind of gerrymandering, certainly we have here in Pennsylvania, but across the country as well. Do you see that as a form of voter suppression?
Well, I don't know about the word suppression, but I see it as a pathology in the way we design our election processes. This is something Ned mentioned. We're the only country in the world that allows politicians to draw their own election districts. In most systems, there are various kinds of independent commissions that have this role when they have districted elections. And I do think that it's a serious problem for the American democratic process that we tolerate the kind of gerrymandering that we do. There has been some movement in recent years towards a greater use of these independent commissions or nonpartisan commissions in various states. And so I'm sort of encouraged that there's been some movement in that direction. The courts have not been willing to get very involved in dealing with this problem. It's too messy and complicated for them. But I do think that's a serious problem for our system. I mean, another area where there's been significant improvement in recent years that may lead to more participation is in the development of online voter registration or automatic voter registration when people reach voting age. One of the biggest barriers to participation in the United States is the registration system, particularly because people in the United States move so frequently and you have to re-register every time you move. And a lot of people don't think about it until an election's coming up and then it's too late. So we've had a tremendous amount of movement just in recent years towards many states now creating these automatic online voter registration systems. And that, I think, is one of the most positive developments in terms of making participation easier.
Ned, if there are competitive races, does that automatically lead to more voter participation?
Yes, it tends to. I think the statistics bear that out. I mean, we could go to compulsory voting like Australia. I don't recommend it, but that would be a way to increase turnout. My philosophy on this is to eliminate barriers and then make it freedom of, you know, make voter participation a free choice in a free society. So if the reason for low turnout is 'cause voters choose to stay home, that's a choice. Now, if it's as a result of gerrymandering and the races aren't competitive, I agree gerrymandering is a pathology that we should try to eliminate.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We've got James from Chester County joining us on Radio Times. Hi, James. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Marty. How you doing?
Good.
I don't hear the Democrats screaming about voter fraud or, you know, even only in the context of gerrymandering. But I just think that, you know, even Al Gore graciously accepted the defeat after that dubious situation in West Palm Beach with the dangling chads and everything, and the subsequent Supreme Court handing the second term to Bush. But I think with this specific candidate, he is just doing a preemptive delegitimizing strike on the Clinton presidency because he's going to move into some kind of non-political, non-politician celebrity status like Sarah Palin, where he's going to, you know, that's going to be his mantra that it was stolen from him.
Well, James, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and there's a, you know, who knows, we're going to see where this race takes us. Do you have any thoughts about that, Ned?
Well, there is a concept that statisticians have developed called a risk-limiting audit, and that means no matter how close the margin of victory that's reported on election night is, you can go back and randomly sample a number of precincts and a number of ballots so that you can be confident that the result was accurate. And that would be a system that I would recommend all states to adopt. A few have, but most haven't at this point. Again, it does require a paper record, but it would mean that that any candidate who tried to delegitimize the result really wouldn't be able to, because you could prove using the risk-limiting audit that it was a fair process.
Rick, do you think if we had public financing of elections, I know sometimes we've tried a version of that, that would increase voter participation?
I'm a little skeptical about that. I don't know that there's much evidence of that in the states that do have public financing in terms of significant increases in participation. You know, people are always concerned about money in politics. It's a long historical concern in the United States. But I'm not sure that the reform efforts in the past have had a significant impact on voter participation and turnout. So there might be good reasons to go to public financing for elections, but I don't know that it's a magic formula for significantly increasing voter turnout.
Let me see what Kiera from Wilmington has to say. Kiera, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi,
I'm calling because I wondered why people hadn't considered making Election Day a national holiday. I think some problems with turnout may have to do with people working very long hours and having a tough time also making it to the polls on that day.
That's an interesting question. Rick, can I put that to you? And it is, you know, if people are going to do in-person voting, it is on a Tuesday, a work day for most people. Would making a national holiday, would that increase voter turnout?
It might. There have been a lot of proposals for that over the years. In fact, one of the more interesting ones has been to put Election Day on Veterans Day, which is already a holiday. Now, that's created some opposition from veterans groups, actually, who are worried about how it might affect Veterans Day. But, you know, as we move towards early voting in more and more states, it's beginning to address this problem or this issue in a different way. I myself do think that Election Day should be a national holiday, and in many countries it is.
To you, Ned, and I wonder about the Supreme Court's ruling of a couple of years ago on the Voting Rights Act. What kind of impact do you think that has had on voting?
A lot. I mean, we're seeing new litigation play out as a result of that decision that you're referring to, where there's been an effort in states that had early voting to cut it back. And it's usually, a legislature controlled by the Republican Party right now cutting back. This is true in North Carolina. It's true in Ohio, where I am. There's a debate about whether or not those cutbacks do violate the Voting Rights Act or not, and exactly what the motive is. Is it a partisan motive? Is it a racially discriminatory motive? Is it politics at work? And that's where the comparison of Pennsylvania with no early voting to begin with, mm-hmm. compared to a state like Ohio that used to have 5 weeks of early voting and cut it back to 4 weeks of early voting, it's sort of an interesting comparison. It might be that any time you cut back something that was very expansive violates the Voting Rights Act, but that cutback may actually make it easier to participate than a state that doesn't have any early voting at all.
I understand exactly what you said. We're going to leave it on that note. My thanks to you, Ned Foley, for joining us today in Radio Times.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Professor at the Moritz College of Law at Ohio State University wrote a book called Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. Richard Pildes, thank you very much for joining us in Radio Times as well.
Happy to have joined you.
And he joined us by Skype, and he's the Sudler Family Professor of Constitutional Law at NYU School of Law. And we began with Jennifer Clark, Executive Director of the Public Interest Law Center here in Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. Much more to talk about. I can see a lot of activity on our Facebook page and lots of comments as well. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thanks for joining us.